We're here now with Nigel Cameron, who is the director of the Institute for Biotechnology and the Human Future. Do I have that correct?
Indeed.
Okay. So, Nigel, how do you think the conference is going?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, I think it's fascinating that ASBH and Glenn McGee would put together a conference of this kind, given that the tradition within the mainline bioethics community has been largely to ignore the sort of insurgent, disenfranchised, but increasingly influential representatives of, you know, a major tradition, in some ways the dominant tradition in American general political, private, religious opinion, on the agenda, which so far has been handled pretty much internally by the elite. Now, I think it's interesting that they've set up this conference for this purpose. I think it's also interesting that there's not exactly a 50-50 division of presenters and chairs and so on the issues. There's been a sort of dominant theme, but there's certainly been courtesy and acceptance of those of us who are somewhat outside the mainstream. I also think it's interesting that they have not invited the people who I think are in some ways the key to this whole thing, who are the sort of disenfranchised progressive left.
Now, who is that, for example?
Well, I mean, people like the environmentalists, the feminists. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Of course, they may have invited individuals and been turned down. But I mean, the sort of position represented by, I suppose, George Annis, Laurie Andrews, and the bioethicists. And of course, some of these are highly sort of involved professional people. But broadly speaking, he would be on the left critics of mainline bioethics rather than the right critics. And of course, one of the interesting ironies of the situation is the left critics and the right critics tend to be saying many of the same things in their critique of the bioethics elite. So I think there's a certain artificiality about this discussion, even though I'm very happy to be party to it.
Don't you think that is part of academic turf battles, though?
There's something in that. I mean, I think that in a sense, perhaps the most interesting thing to be talking about here behind the scenes is the politics of the ASBH and Glenn McGee. I mean, the sort of politics behind this event, the politics which is going on here, as we all say we don't want to be political, and as power is being brokered in the way that those who are in power tend to broker power.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think there's hope for commensurability?
I think there's a good deal of hope, but my sense is that it will not come from those who talk about the importance of commensurability. I mean, one of my convictions is that you cannot be bipartisan unless you're partisan. It's only the partisan who can be bipartisan. Those who don't care, or those who simply want to quash debate, or those who want to have business as usual, I don't say that's true of at all those in mainline bioethics, but these are features which are there in some of those and in some of their thinking and so on. I think that is a sort of effete exercise in politics as in the world of ideas. Those who have real commitments and will fight for them tend to be the ones who ultimately are able to discover where conventionality lies and to make common cause.
Finding common ground, then.
Yes, and I think there's enormous common ground to be made, but by and large it is not being made within the confines of the professional bioethics community.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
No, many things I could. I wrote an article for something recently. I think it was for a German book on bioethics in different cultures. I was asked to write on bioethics in America. I produced a kind of history of the Bush administration's approach to biopolicy. And I gave it a subtitle like, you know, The Elite versus the People. And I think it's the insurgent character of genuine popular, democratic, demographic opinion, which has finally got the mainstream elite interested in having some of these conversations, which is a wonderful thing.
Now, one of the things that certainly seems that, one of the things that, issues that everybody on this panel agreed upon was universal health care coverage. Do you think that there's any hope for that in the near future?
Well, I think there may be, but in fact this is a rather good example, because I think that I would have thought politically the only hope for universal healthcare coverage is if a proposal comes from the right.
Can you explain that a little further?
Well, I mean, of course, I think it was a tragedy of the Clinton initiative, which I think was conducted with great incompetence and hubris and many other qualities too, that made it a very easy target. I mean, hubris is just, you know, the last thing you want when you're trying to conduct a revolution and get away with it. I think many of the goals of the Clinton proposal were very good. I think some of the mechanisms were bizarre.
Wasn't it based upon, I forget the mathematician who wrote, the movie was made about Brilliant Mind. Do you know?
I know who you mean.
Yes, his name escapes me at the moment. But I understand that the formula was based upon equitable distribution and this mathematical principle of
equality. Well, I mean, there were estimable goals involved, because by and large our politics is not about ends, it's about means. I mean, there are some ends that we hold distinctively, but by and large our politics is good. And the notion that you send doctors to jail because mm-hmm. they practice privately. I mm-hmm. mean, in the UK, you know, which in some sense is the model of how you do this, both for those who hate it and for those who love it. No doctor has ever gone to jail in 60 years for practicing private medicine.
Nigel, you said that the healthcare coverage by the right is the way to go. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, I mean, in terms of the political likelihood of there being some sort of universal access system in place,
mm-hmm.
I think it in the politics would only work if this came from conservatives.
What about Massachusetts?
Oh, well, I think many things are going on here, and of course Massachusetts has a Republican governor who is, we are told, considering running for the presidency.
And he also, but he has a Democratic legislature.
Well, as in fact, for many years did our present president when he was governor of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me, ultimately, you've got to be bipartisan, but the point is, if the rhetoric is coming from where it came from under the Clinton health plan,
but that is.
We'll get nowhere.
But the, well,
I'm
I was
making
going to
a
say.
Value judgment. I'm just
no,
making
no, no,
no.
But the Massachusetts, legislation covers everyone,
mm-hmm.
and the from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, okay, because I certainly could be wrong on this. This administration has proposed health care coverage for everyone who's employed,
mm-hmm.
And has put the burden upon the employer. Now, from what I understand, that is not necessarily the case in Massachusetts, that you don't have to be employed, you just have to be on the grid. Do I have that correct?
I think you're right. I mean, this is not an expert in which I have particular expertise, and once you get into it, the only thing you can do is try to understand the system.
Right.
I think there are all sorts of models there. I mean, I think the notion of a single sort of European-style single-payer system is not going to work in the U.S. And in some ways, we've come to terms with that fact, I think, you know, across much of the spectrum. I think some of these state initiatives are very interesting and may provide working models. And if you're a working model in the state, then it really has a chance of being adopted by other states and so on. You get a grand approach. Because one of the problems with the rhetoric of this discussion is that mm-hmm. we have something akin to universal health care in the U.S. with mm-hmm. Medicaid and Medicare and the VA and so on. We have huge areas of state provision, social provision of medicine. And these systems operate very like the European systems do. And of course, were intended for particular groups who were disadvantaged mm-hmm. and so on. Now, as we know, the tragedy.
Oh, like the senators and congressmen? Sorry, I'll probably have to take that out of the interview.
Or embellish it. The basic problem is the working poor. And I think the working poor are a wonderful conservative cause. I mean, this is the point. It isn't that the indigent, mm-hmm. in fact, are the people who get it. I mean, Medicaid and Medicare do provide. Element of access
mm-hmm.
on the part of the most indigent members of society. I mean, the most pressing issue is the working poor.
Oh, I agree with that.
You know?
No, I certainly
and that
agree
is
with
why
that.
It seems to me the right should be, and many, you know, on the right are very concerned. And I think there are interesting questions as to whether some of these private saving schemes and so on and so forth, which are proposed, you know, would ever work with that constituency, given
right.
the social and cultural, you know, context in which you're talking about doing these things.
Right.
But it seems to me that there's a certain inexorability about our move to a universal access system, particularly if it is not proposed in a politicized way, a la Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a chance that the name-calling can stop?
Well, I mean, there are, you know, like capital P and small p, there are capital N names and small N names. You know, I mean, I've been called a human racist and a speciesist and who knows what by some of my quote colleagues, unquote, in these discussions, which I think is bizarre. And I mean, I don't go around calling them Nazis and this and that. I mean, at one level, these are terms of abuse, I think, are absurd. At the same time, I mean, obviously, you know, back in Genesis 1, you know, man named the animals. I mean, we're taxonomists. I mean, we organize so we can understand. And so at some point, I mean, talking about liberal or conservative is useful. I think part of the problem with using the sort of political sort of unilinear division of liberals and conservatives as our model for everything
uh-huh.
is it breaks down pretty fundamentally when you get into a transformative set of issues like these issues, in which the real
the real commonalities in politics and broader culture do not lie between those who are fiscal conservatives and fiscal liberals, or social conservatives and social liberals in general terms. They tend to lie between those who are social conservatives concerned about the integrity of human nature and the dignity of the individual, and whereas the language may be different, you find them on both sides of the spectrum, what I call the centers of conscience on right and left. Now, this doesn't fit this spectrum idea. You can play around with modeling here, but I foresee a major transformation in our left-right politics arising because of the increasing dominance of these questions that I think will rearrange, you know, the entire political landscape.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Nigel.
You're welcome.